not exactly sure, according to the introduction that I got, as to whether I'm going to meet all the expectations of what the introduction promised. What I want to talk about a little bit today are some issues in kashrus, or some points in kashrus that I think maybe you might find interesting, and that in a certain degree or a certain way kind of overlap with some of potential legal issues. Really, what we start with is the fact that kashrus supervision, a lot of people are not sure whether it is necessary, whether it's not necessary. I tend to believe that it is necessary, not just because that's what I do for a living, but because I see what's going on in food production facilities, not just in the United States, but South America also, Canada, a lot of different places. The world has gotten increasingly complex. It's a serious, serious business now. It used to be that when it came to food production, so it was a very simple process. Everything was very basic. Things were mostly natural. Now you would hardly recognize anything that you're going to see in any particular food production facility, in a factory, no matter where it is, not just anywhere else in the world, but also in the United States. What I really want to base things around today was something that's out there that really brings out the need for kosher supervision. There's any number of items that you can buy that not necessarily is the federal government filled with rabbis, and therefore there's a lot of different definitions out there that don't necessarily jive as far as what the government thinks they are and as far as what kashrus would think they are. So, if anybody's familiar with an area called CFR 101, Section 101, which is really the truth in labeling, not really truth in labeling exactly, but labeling standards for food products. There's a lot of things that we go out and we buy, and we think that they're one thing, and through kashrus and through kosher supervision, it's not necessarily exactly what it seems to be. I guess the best example that everybody has, that people come up to me and ask me all the time because they think that there's something wrong with me and all the other rabbis in the OU, is something that's out there. If anybody's ever gotten non-dairy creamer, you don't want to put milk in your coffee, you're lactose intolerant, you have a dairy allergen, so you go out and you buy something called non-dairy creamer. So I must have been asked this question 750 times already, and probably 751 even, which is, if it's non-dairy creamer, so why is there an OUD, right, saying that it's dairy, or most of them that are out there? Which is a very good question. Answer is, because there's milk in it. That's a big problem, because if there's milk in it, so then how can it be non-dairy? Reality is there's no milk in non-dairy creamer. What there is something called sodium caseinate. Sodium caseinate is one of the proteins, is the protein in the, or one of the components of milk, which is separated off from the fluid milk and taken and added as a binder, something to kind of give it a thickness, give it consistency. In almost every non-dairy creamer you're going to find out there, you're going to find that there's some type of caseinate, sodium caseinate, potassium caseinate, calcium caseinate, one of those, which, according to us, makes it dairy. According to the federal government, it does not make it dairy, and therefore they can label it as non-dairy. There's a very compelling scientific reason as to why a non-dairy creamer that has a bunch of milk derivatives in it can be labeled, according to the United States government, as non-dairy, which is that all the non-dairy creamer manufacturers decided that if they would have to put it down as dairy, people wouldn't buy it. So therefore, they convinced the government that as part of the standard of identity of something called non-dairy creamer, you can have caseinate in it, and it can be a dairy item. So if you would buy it off the shelf, and you would look at it, being a regular consumer, you probably wouldn't know what caseinate is. You buy it, says non-dairy, put it in your milk, have it with your steak, maybe baste your steak in non-dairy creamer. I don't know all these fancy things that people are doing, but you would wind up with a real busted bacala, a real milk and meat question in your kitchen. Not a question, a real milk and meat problem, because this stuff is really dairy. It's just an example of where, if you're going to go with what we commonly refer to, or we commonly look at as labeling, where it's going to give one appearance, and in reality, what you're dealing with is something totally different. If you are lactose intolerant, or worse, if you have a dairy allergen, I would strongly advise not using non-dairy creamers, unless it says very clearly on there a hashgacha, and it says parv next to it, and even then I would check the ingredients, because sometimes people mislabel things. This is like an excellent example of where we think of food as one thing, and in reality, kashrus-wise, certainly, kashrus will bring out that it's really something else. Second example. Let's go through a couple of them, which kind of will deal with some of the experiences that we've had out there in the big, bad world of food production. Second one is when you go out and you buy 100% cranberry juice. It says cranberry juice, 100% juice. So now, I don't know if anybody has ever drinking, whatever the word is. If you ever had one, has anybody ever had 100% cranberry juice? You have. Okay, then you don't have a stomach. Because the level of acidity in cranberry juice is so high that if you would drink 100% cranberry juice, it would burn a hole from one end to the other. Maybe even up and down also. No, if you dilute it, it's not 100% juice. It's not 100% juice. And according to the federal government, of which, if you doubt me, I have a copy of the regulations right here in front of me, plus the handy-dandy guide that they give you that the FDA issues as far as how to label products. Very specifically, if it says 100% juice, it's got to be 100% juice. Unfortunately, what they don't tell you is what juice is in your cranberry juice. Because the only statement that they're making on that label is 100% juice. But they never told you what juice is inside. We say cranberry juice. Well, in order to call cranberry juice, it must have cranberry juice. And according to the federal government, in order to label it cranberry juice, you have to have a certain amount of actual cranberry juice in the juice. But cranberry juice and 100% juice are two very different animals. And if you pick up your bottle of juice you pick up in the shop right, and you look on the back of 100% juice, you will see cranberry juice. Oh, thank you. Somebody saved my life here. Thank you. If you pick up something that says 100% juice, cranberry juice, 100% juice, look on the back in the ingredients, you will see cranberry juice plus a mix of either white grape juice, apple juice, or pear juice. Whichever juice is cheaper that week, and the price fluctuates as the markets go up and down. People are very surprised anybody has ever gone out and bought from the K people that make kosher grape juice. Seem to dominate the world of kosher grape juice. You may be shocked to find out that grape juice is probably of the cheapest juices that you can find. No one, unfortunately, has told the sellers of kosher grape juice that it's so cheap, but regular white grape juice concentrate, basically between apple, pear, and white grape, are the cheapest juices out there. So those juices are used as filler. They don't have very much of a color to them, so they're not going to affect the way that the final product looks. They really don't have that strong a taste to them, so they're not going to affect the taste of the final product, too. So I could take anywhere between 15 and, if you're lucky, there is one cranberry juice out there on the market that actually has, when they make it for Passover, they put in about 23%. Actual cranberry juice, which is the highest cranberry content you're going to find out there. So, other than that, they can mix that with apple, pear, or white grape, and you have 100% juice. And in reality, it could very well not be kosher, because as we all know, that grape juices have a very serious kosher concern to them. They have to be made with very special and complicated oversight to make sure that they're made correctly. Perfect example. Now, aside from that, why can't I just go out and buy a juice? If I see something out there labeled, okay, 100% orange juice, So over there, they can't fake you out. According to the regulations, if they say 100% orange juice, it's got to be 100% orange juice. So that you could buy. Cranberry, not. So if I find something out there that says 100% orange juice, why can't I just go out and buy that? Well, that already leads back to the step before that. Sometimes you might be able to. Most of the time, you wouldn't. Because you need to know how the juice was processed. Because nobody's standing there in a factory with a bunch of oranges and squeezing oranges into a bottle. This is not what happens out there. What happens is we're buying orange juice concentrate from where it might be. Orange juice, maybe not a good example. Apple juice. Apple juice or an apple juice concentrate from whatever country it might come from. It could come from Uruguay, it could come from China, it could come from Argentina, it could come from Israel, it could come from the former Soviet Union. The odds that you have ever drunk actual USA apple juice are very, very slight because it's too expensive. So everybody's importing and bringing in huge totes and tankers and everything full of apple juice. But once they get that juice, of late, the standard has been in the industry to go and to pasteurize them. So once we put a juice into a pasteurizer, then we start having all sorts of potential kosher problems. Because when you're pasteurizing a product, so then you're cooking it. Right? The reason that we pasteurize is because there's bacteria in the juice itself. If you don't get rid of that bacteria, so then the juice is going to have a shelf life of about 15 seconds or 30 seconds. And they want it to stay forever so that they'll be able to sell as much as they can for as long as they can. So what they do is they pasteurize it by cooking it up, so then they kill the bacteria and the juice doesn't become spoiled. Whenever you open up a milk, all milk is pasteurized. You open up milk, it's spoiled. You smell that spoiled smell, that's not the milk. That's the bacteria in the milk, which has grown because you're beyond the date when the pasteurization was effective. It'll kill the bacteria for a certain amount of time, but beyond a certain amount of time, the bacteria are very hardy fellows. And they come right back and they say, you know, hey, you tried to kill me, I'm going to get you. So there's bacteria everywhere, including in this wonderful bottle of Diet Coke with the OU on it. Thank you. So in a lot of juices now, it used to be the standard was just to bottle them because people were not concerned. Nowadays, basically you're pasteurizing everything. And once you're pasteurizing something, so it's the equivalent of cooking it, and once you cook it, if you cook something not kosher in the same pasteurizer, so then unless you kosher it, you sterilize it to get the flavor of the non-kosher out of there, so then you're going to wind up with the non-kosher apple juice. You could have a trafe apple juice. You know, say, well, how's that going to happen? I have a bunch of juice plants. It's very popular out there. I don't know if anybody has ever seen it. I try and stay as far away from it because this stuff smells just about as bad as anything that you're going to find on the streets in New York. If you ever seen clam juice, oh man, that's wicked. Clam is wicked. You know, and you buy clam juice, but it seems that in the Hispanic population, clam happens to be, for some reason, a very, very popular item. And in fact, a large store which seems to dominate just about all of the economy in the United States and throughout the world seems to like clam juice and seems to sell some of it. So any company that's producing for the Big W store, so then they're probably going to be producing clam because they want clam out there. Meantime, the amount of clam actually in the clam juice is so minimal that it's because this stuff is really, really potent. You don't want to touch it. You don't want to get anywhere near it because with the gets on your clothes, you're going to be no, well, if you're antisocial, it'll be a great thing because no one will get near you for about 2 weeks after that because this really smells bad. But they process at least a minimal amount of that mixed together with water and other flavors to make a clam juice. Do it on the pasteurizer. It's not kosher. Got to kosher it. You do an apple juice right afterwards. Anything you do on that pasteurizer until you kosher it is going to be not kosher. And therefore, you can't even really go out unless you're going to buy something that's going to be an orange juice concentrate, which is just the actual orange juice with the water removed, and then they froze it down in Florida. So when you do that, then you might be safe. Other than that, you shouldn't really buy it without any type of reliable kosher supervision because you never know what kind of equipment it was made on.
And another interesting phenomenon out there that people accuse us of really being out of our minds. And yet, it's a strange thing. We all know, and let's just put this down as a basic, we all know of the basics out there in kosher, right? The basic rule, not to be messed with, not to be fooled with, not to be trifled with, and never, ever, ever to be violated, if you are a kosher person, is we do not put milk and meat together, right? Simple rule. You'd be shocked at how many people out there in food manufacturing facilities have no idea about this. I always explain it to them. In fact, I tried to explain it in Spanish yesterday down in Mexico. Tried to explain about the carne and the leche, but they didn't quite grasp it. I'm not sure. I think they thought I'm putting a Volkswagen next to a Mazda or something. But trying to explain to them, you know, the idea, I told them, you know, you have bleach. Bleach is a great cleaner. You have ammonia. Ammonia is a great cleaner. If you mix ammonia and bleach together to get a really great cleaner, about the only thing that's going to clean is going to be you. Because a mix of ammonia and bleach is as toxic as things come. The fumes will kill you. If you doubt me, talk to my mother. She had a very good friend who decided to clean her floor in her bathroom with, she used bleach, and then she used an ammonia cleaner, and they buried her the next day. Because that's about as toxic as it comes, that type of mix. Even though each one by itself is no problem. Well, when it comes to kashrus, same thing is true. We can have kosher meat, although it seems in the world today it is getting harder and harder and harder to find kosher meat. But that's a whole different discussion. But we can have kosher meat, which is fine. We can have kosher milk, which is fine. But if we're going to put the two together, we have some serious, serious issues. Good. If you go into your grocery store, you are going to find on the shelf the following two products. You will find a product called natural meat flavored spaghetti sauce made by a company, I think, called Colonna out in New Jersey. You will also find in a different section, unless you have a really small grocery store that has only one shelf, you're going to find another product called, I think, Old London natural Parmesan flavored Melba toast, something like that. Now, there is one common denominator between these two products. On each of them, you will find the following kosher designation: OU Parv. So now, the world thinks that we're out of our minds. I talk to my children, they'll tell you they don't think it, they know it, but world thinks that we are out of our minds, because how in the world can you have a meat spaghetti sauce that's going to be parve? How can you have a cheese covered Melba toast that's parve? And in reality, you can actually take that spaghetti sauce, put it on the Melba toast, and have yourself a real good kosher party and have no problem. The reason for that is because if you read that label carefully, you will see that nobody ever said that that spaghetti sauce has meat in it. Nor did anybody ever say that that Melba toast has cheese in it, has Parmesan cheese. What it did say on the label was that it's meat-flavored spaghetti sauce. What it did say on the Melba toast label is that it's cheese-flavored Melba toast. So you say, oh, Rabbi, we are a group of the best and brightest legal minds that will enter the legal profession in the next 3, 4, 5, depending on how well you're doing in school, years. And you can't put that one by us, because we know you have to read every word on that label. And that label didn't just say meat-flavored spaghetti sauce, and it didn't just say Parmesan cheese-flavored Melba toast. It said one other word. It said natural Parmesan cheese flavored Melba toast and natural meat flavored spaghetti sauce. So we got you, and you should go to law school instead of going to rabbi school, because that's my wife. You should go to law school instead of rabbi school. In fact, you should go back to first grade and learn how to read, and learn how to read the word natural. Because since it's natural meat, hey, coming from a cow. And since it's natural cheese, it's coming from milk. Well, the rabbi says back to all the legal eagles over here,
Sorry, Charlie, or Charlene, whoever is here. Sorry, you didn't read that close enough. Because it does say flavor, too. And whenever we start to talk about flavors, we are getting into an area which has changed the whole face of the kosher world and the food world and everything world. Because just because something says that it's a natural meat flavor does not mean that it has to have meat in it. All it means is that it has to be a flavor. It has to have a meat flavor to it, according to whoever invented it. And it means that every ingredient or raw material or sub-ingredient or component that went into that flavor is a natural source. So if I could go outside and find a piece of grass and take a leaf from a tree and take a, I don't know what, and put those all together, grind them up, melt them up, whatever I'm going to do to them, and have it come out taste like meat, I now have created something called a natural meat flavor without any meat in it. And the same way, if I'm going to go and find anything that has a natural source, I'm going to take it, I'm going to put everything together, and it's going to come out tasting like Parmesan cheese. As long as the sources were natural, I have now a natural Parmesan cheese, even though there's no milk, no cheese, no anything like that in it. So you can go and have a party now. The biggest example many years ago, and people still screaming about it, is Bacos. Bacos taste like bacon. They tell me, I wouldn't know, of course, but supposedly tastes like bacon. But let me tell you something, you know, as bad as bacon might be for you, I think Bacos health-wise might be either a long time. You live a long time because you are what you eat, and there's so many preservatives in that stuff that you're going to live forever. But be that as it may, it's a natural bacon flavor, but there's no bacon. It wouldn't be kosher if there was bacon in it, in that flavor. So we run to the World Fairs, and now you can have a real kosher party, a non-kosher kosher party. As the Gemara talks about, and Chulin says that for everything in the world that is non-kosher, there is a kosher-tasting equivalent. Someplace, somehow. You say, bacon. Where is that? Well, bacon. So you got it. Took a couple thousand years, but there it is. So now you can have like a real non-kosher kosher party, because you could take your spaghetti sauce, your natural meat-flavored spaghetti sauce, and put it on your your Parmesan, natural Parmesan cheese flavored Malta toast, and you could eat that all day. You could go in front of the rabbi, not on Yom Kippur, but let's say on Shabbos, at the Kiddush, you put it out there, you say, okay, let's go. Cheese and meat. And really there's no cheese and no meat. So the world has become a wonderful place for kosher people, because now you can have just about anything and it can be parv. You can have parv meat. That's amazing. You can add a parv cheese. No problem. As long as it tastes like it. Just can't call it cheese. According to these papers over here, you have to call it flavored cheese or something of the equivalent. Can't call it cheese. That's all. Unfortunately, that works not just to our advantage as a kosher consumer, but it also works the other way. For example, I go out to any coffee stand over here, and I want to buy a hazelnut coffee. I say, well, hey, Rabbi, come on. What's wrong? Hazelnut coffee. Tastes good. And you find me something not kosher about a hazelnut, which I maybe could, but generally, let's say a hazelnut wouldn't be a problem, wouldn't be a non-kosher item. I haven't seen any pigs that are made of hazelnuts. But so you say, well, why can't I buy that? That is coffee and hazelnut. Well, it's not hazelnut. It's hazelnut flavor. So, well, what could be wrong with that? Well, it's natural hazelnut flavor. You say, well, what could be wrong with that? So it's all natural. Yeah. I don't know. A cow is natural. Pig is natural. As long as everything that goes into that flavor has a source that could be called natural as opposed to artificial, you run the possibility that you could have something very non-kosher in there, and you would never know it. Because what could be wrong with hazelnut? I'll tell you what could be wrong with hazelnut. First thing is, every flavor is just to avoid a complicated discussion. But to understand what flavors are just very concentrated, very highly concentrated tastes of one degree or another. Well, you know, like we said about the clam, you have clam flavor, you get a little bit on that in your finger, you're going to smell for 3 weeks. Well, flavors, you don't want that. If we put, you know, we put a bottle of this, we put a little bit of what would be a concentrated hazelnut flavor in here, you couldn't get near it.
So what has to be done is that flavor has to be spread across, has to be placed in a carrier, which is going to spread it and equally divide it throughout the liquid flavor compound, so that when you'll put a little drop in here, it's not going to be so potent and so concentrated, you won't be able to taste it. Well, that carrier is oftentimes, number one, oftentimes lactose, which is milk. A lot of flavors you'll get, hazelnut flavor could be 30% milk, 30% lactose, which is a component of milk, because that's what they're using to spread it out and make it less concentrated. Or a carrier is oftentimes some type of polysorbate, something split off of an oil, a fatty acid type of compound, which of course could come from any type of oil, could come from an animal oil, could come from a vegetable oil. There is no way to tell, and nobody has to declare that to you. So the only way that you can really be sure, if you're going to buy anything that has a natural flavor in it, is to be certain that you buy it with the reputable hashgacha, like the OU, because we're checking to make sure that these flavors are not problematic for the product. Now you say, okay, Rabbi, that I am going to go on an artificial kick, right? Whole world's going organic, whole world's going natural. I am going to be safe. I will only buy artificially flavored things, and then I'll for sure be safe. Well, that's not going to save you either, unfortunately, because, see, if I take a product and I put down natural flavor in it, and I don't put a natural flavor, some nut's going to go out there and sue me because you said it was natural and it wasn't. However, I don't believe that the converse would be true. That if I label something that's artificially flavored and then I put a natural flavor in it, I don't think anybody's suing. And if you try to, you get thrown right out to say, I bought this because it was artificial and instead you gave me the higher price natural. You know, that's not going to happen. So even if it says artificial, and there is an important acronym that we all know, conscious, which is the word WONF, W-O-N-F, which is not what you do to the guy in the factory when he puts ham into your kosher product. You don't want them. WONF means with other natural flavors. So in a flavor company, I can take, let's say, a cranberry flavor, and as long as one of the components of that is cranberry flavor, I can put whatever else I want to put in there, as long as it's natural, and I can legally call that cranberry flavor, WONF, with other natural flavors. So you can never tell when it comes to flavors. That's a big deal. Always a very big deal. The last thing I'd like to mention, the fourth example, very quickly, and then if you want to ask questions, I hear that people here don't ask questions. Only Socrates challenges. He does not want to ask, though. But the last thing to talk about is what is known in the world when I was young, which was many, many centuries ago, probably before, when they were still writing in Latin everywhere, because I'm like really old. But when I was young, there was a great invention which came out, which was something called 100% vegetable shortening. You're all probably too young to even ask your parents about it if they kept kosher back then. You could ask them about that. The day when someone came out with the idea of 100% vegetable shortening was a glorious day for the Jewish people, let me tell you. I remember the first place where it happened was something called Hydrox cookies. I don't know if they still make those or not. Right? Those, I think they changed them to cholesterol cookies. But Hydrox cookies were the first ones that came out, had no kosher on them, had no hashgacha. But the world went around saying, you can eat those without a problem. Because the problem with the cookies always was, maybe they're putting in animal fat, maybe they're putting in tallow or lard or something like that. But now, the Sunshine Biscuit Company has promised us, has assured us on that big label, that they only use 100% vegetable shortening. And therefore, hey. And the world was a party. It was a party for a short while, unfortunately, because all parties must end. And this one ended when someone came to the realization that it might technically be correct that the shortening or the oil that they use in those cookies is 100% vegetable. Unfortunately, it's most likely made in a plant, in an oil plant, that also makes 100% animal pig shortening and animal oil. And the real problem over there is, if you've ever seen an oil plant, I don't imagine that you have. It's really not for the faint of heart. It's kind of overwhelming. I've been South America, they sent me to South America to see
to see a number of them, because in the United States it is somewhat uncommon now to find anybody who's making an animal-based fat or oil. It is certainly much less common than it used to be. However, once you cross the border, so then it's all over the place. So, you know, one of the places that they sent me on a number of occasions was to go down south of the border and to look at some of these oil plants, these oil facilities where they're doing vegetable and animal, and see whether there was any way for us to make a kosher oil come out of that plant. Well, you say, what's wrong with the oils? Oil, soybean oil, cottonseed oil, palm oil, 100% true, but every oil is treated. In a world of no trans fats, which is what our world has become today, trans fats are the equivalent of cancer and leprosy in the world, and you might as well, you know, someone's going to have to make a cigarette out of them, because imagine smoking trans fats. You'd be like the worst person in the entire United States if you did that. Trans fats, so all oils are manipulated. I mean, the idea of a trans fat of an oil is that somehow we manipulate it by esterification or else hydrogenation, which is just to put it under pressure and pound it with hydrogen atoms using the nickel catalyst in order to alter the melting point of the oil so what would have been liquid will stay solid. There's any number of pieces to the puzzle. But all of those machines, which are multi-million dollar pieces of equipment, a deodorizer in an oil company is probably about 6, 7, 8 stories tall, and costs a whole heck of a lot of money. And most companies do what we do too. When we have a house, you want to buy a house, costs, you know, say $100,000. Everyone wants to know where the house is. Let's say you have a house that costs $400,000. So most of us are not taking $400,000 out of our pocket and paying cash for that. Most of us are going to finance such a purchase. Well, all the big and the little and the medium food producers, when they buy a piece of equipment for a bunch of millions of dollars, they finance it too. And because they finance it, every second that they own it, that is not working, costs them money. And if they could have two or get by with one, they will always get by with one because two costs double. And therefore, that same hydrogenation vessel or refining vessel or deodorizer, whatever it was, or Votator, which would make a shortening, that's going to make your 100% vegetable oil or 100% vegetable shortening, very likely an hour before it was filled with 100% animal fat or animal oil. And of course, they tell you that they clean it out, well, legally, to what degree do they have to clean it out in order to maintain that this is 100%, especially if they say, well, we're just going to flush it out and the first 10,000 pounds of oil that comes out we'll get rid of to flush out the system. It doesn't work like that. Unfortunately, it's not very effective. And therefore, if you find a product that says 100% vegetable oil, it's entirely possible that it's 100% TRAFE. Unless it's an oil that was produced in an oil company that's done under a reputable hashgacha, and I got to tell you, to just begin to look at an oil company, an oil plant, just begin to look at it and make a decision whether you can actually produce kosher oil in an oil plant that does animal and vegetable, whether you can make enough separations and make enough of a separate system in order to keep the animal and the vegetable completely separate, that's about 3 or 4 18-hour days of just looking at the plant and learning what's going on in order to be able to start to decide whether you can do it. It's a very complicated process, but it's one of the many things that we do.